As I said yesterday, that today we're going to write down the metric of the universe. And then we'll throw a test particle that, such as a galaxy, and then see how it moves. If only under the influence of the metric. So how the geodesic movement of galaxy we also apply it to the photon, sneakily. Those are two types of things we know. Something move relatively slow, and something move at the speed of light. And then, in the end, we want to know the evolution of the universe. So F equals ma for the universe. So let's get us started. Yesterday we tried to say, oh, look at all these great experiments we have, and we argue that to some extent, to a very good extent, we can treat our universe as a homogeneous and isotropic space at any time. And such a space is maximally symmetric, and it only has three cases. It has a constant positive curvature, constant zero curvature, constant negative curvature. And with that guidance, we can already write down such a space. And I hope you have gone through that calculation again and convinced yourself such a space is given by such a metric, multiplied by this a squared thing, which is basically, when we're talking about a sphere, that's the radius of the sphere. So it describes how curved the space is. So this is a three space that is maximally symmetric. And we think that if our universe is homogeneous isotropic, there must be some observer that will see the universe like this at any time he sees. And these are the special observer. So they have a name called a co-moving observer. They sort of co-move with the universe. Why they are special? If you think some observer can see the universe as homogeneous and isotropic at any time he wishes, and if you think a universe observer next to him just moving like 1 meter per second, the constant velocity, the relatively moving observer, he's not going to say the universe as homogeneous as isotropic. He has a preference direction. So such observer that will see such a metric at any time of his life is indeed very special. But since the metric look the simplest, in his point of view, we're always talking about the metric of the universe in the coordinate system of the co-moving observer. And he co-moves with the expanding universe. Okay, in terms of him, the metric, which you can heard about, it's the Robert Wilson metric. It's the RW metric, sometimes called FRW metric, sometimes it's called FRW metric. It's hard to keep track. That's all the last name have ever been listed in this metric. But this metric is really relative. Simple says if you want to write down the line element of the universe, you can say, well, there is a time component. Let's just make this A depend on time. Well, I'll first argue this, you know, definitely works. Then I'll argue that it's also kind of unique. Which is, then we write down metric says, well, this works, it's unique, what the? So this definitely fits our bill. You pick a time, this become a constant, then this observer sees exactly what we showed before. It's a constantly curved space. So this seems to be definitely what we want. You might have wondered, I could have write down something from dt squared, but you have seen the trick in GR already. When that happens, you can just redefine your t to be absorbed. So you can always pick this thing to be one, as long as you can redefine t to be something complicated. And you were like, but what about the cross terms? But if you have anything like a dt dx term, dt dy term, dt dz term, that will pick a preferred direction. So it's not isotropic anymore. So this is actually the most general metric you can write down that satisfies the condition that at any time it is a maximum symmetric space. So we're done. Huh, that's the metric of the universe. Well, if you look at the notes or anywhere else, there are some other variations by doing a bunch of redefinitions. When they are relevant, we'll mention it. But this is the metric. You just let the curvature depend on the time, and then you add the time part of the line element. So the coordinate system of this metric is called the co-moving coordinates. So let's just, for a second, take curvature to be zero. Then basically you can write down your metric element just looks like Minkowski, except you have a scale factor. Sorry, this thing has a name called a scale factor. And for a lot of part of the course, almost like the entire part of course, we're trying to study this thing, because that's the only thing that's left. If you have a general metric, it has 10 components. But if you impose the symmetry of homogeneity in isotropic, this is the only thing left, plus a curvature parameter tells you how curved the universe is. So the scale factor is very important. So if you look at this, basically the co-moving coordinates, they don't really change. Okay, let's say expanding universe in one dimension. So this is the one space dimension, then I have some coordinates. And if I have two dimensions, I can think of it's a balloon that has dots on it. And now, as time goes, universe expand, say a factor of two. Then the coordinate of this point is still 1, 2, 3. You can think of it as a universe has a bunch of galaxies just still there. They are static, they are not moving, except the universe is expanding. Then their coordinate does not change. All the distance between the origins, say us, and the galaxies is only described by the scale factor. Yeah? So the coordinate does not change if the galaxies doesn't just wobble around. If you have, this is a one dimension, has like four galaxies. And then they will just, as time goes, universe expands, but the coordinate doesn't change. So this x describes the co-moving coordinate, and the at capture the expansion of the universe. So in such a coordinate system, these two things get separated. Okay, what else do I want to mention about this metric? Not much. Let's study a galaxy. So a real galaxy, it does move. So the coordinates of a real galaxy does move a little bit besides the expansion of the universe. For example, they might get attracted by some other galaxies. Or it might have some initial velocity. Then you just throw the galaxy there and you ask what happens. So the physical distance between the galaxy to us is defined to be wherever the coordinate is, and then has multiplied by the scale factor. And as you say, in such a metric, that's how we measure spatial distance. So now we can ask, if we have a physical galaxy, what's the physical speed of it? Or velocity, but we're doing in components. So in the natural thing, as we worked on in first year Newtonian mechanics, is that whenever I have a distance, I can do the derivative to dt and wonder about the velocity. That's not something crazy to do. Okay. And the next step is not crazy either. It says that I use Leibniz rule. Yeah? Okay. So what we do is the first term is, I'm going to write it as a dot. So an over dot is always means derivative against the time of a co-moving observer. And I'm going to divide it by A and multiply by A. And the reason I do that is they combine to give me the physical distance again. And this thing will give it a name called a peculiar velocity. It's peculiar because it describes the wobbling of the galaxy on the coordinate. So it's the change of the coordinates giving the galaxy this speed. And on the other hand, this thing is given by, okay. So this, as I said, I write it that way because I want to combine it to physics distance. And this thing is something famous defined to be Hubble parameter. Which, of course, depend on the time. But if you just look at this, the first half of this velocity, it kind of looks like our Hubble's law. So the velocity and the distance is related by some proportional thing. So we'll come back to this point later again, why this A dot A is the thing we should identify with the Hubble parameter so that today it equals to the Hubble constant that Hubble measured. And this thing, as we said, it just describes how galaxy wobbles. So this makes sense. If you look at the galaxy, the velocity of the galaxy has two contributions. One of them is because the universe is expanding, so they're moving away from us. The other contribution is, well, it might be wobbling around. Independent of fact, if the universe is not expanding, they might still be moving. So it has two contributions. Yeah? So if there are two contributions to a physical quantity, what's a natural question to ask? Exactly, which is dominant? Yeah, it's nice, right? If you study two things, it's much harder than study one thing. If you somehow can throw one away, then we're happy. Well, to study this question, we're going to make use of our metric and study the geodesic motion of the galaxy. I know. Hopefully we'll benefit from this calculation because it's not a short one. We'll use the result twice and give us some insights. So it is a very interesting calculation to carry out. So we'll put it in two steps. First, we need an equation. And the second, well, we need to solve it. Actually, the first part is harder. Okay, so let's just do something with that metric. It's a really, really nice metric already. But whenever we deal with GR, even this metric doesn't look that appealing. Actually, besides Minkowski, there's not many appealing metrics. Okay, so we're going to use some pure notation just to make sure that we highlight what we want and hide what I don't want. So this is just a notation, a cluster notation for whatever happens in the spatial. So I want to write it in this way such that to show you the calculation we do actually validates for any curved universe, for any universe. So I can just capture this whole thing, go back to the Cartesian coordinate, and call them, so you can definitely define this thing called the spatial metric, and then call this whole thing the spatial metric. So we can write any metric like this, with this cluster notation. I'm just trying to hide things. Otherwise, I have to, you know, copy this whole thing again and again without really getting any insights. So that's just a notation. And the next thing is what you have already learned in GR says this is the definition of minus d tau squared proper time. Yeah? The definition of the proper time is minus the line element. That seems, okay, silly things to do. The next thing we do is also what you have already seen in GR, is divide the whole thing by d tau squared. Yeah? You might have recall something like u mu equals minus 1 that you have seen in GR. This is exactly what I'm doing, is that I have and there is this really funky thing that I'm not going to write out what it is, equals minus 1. Yeah, this notation is just divide this crazy thing by d tau squared without writing out whatever it is. Okay, so now I'm going to use a very weird convention, which means I can't keep track of where m is. I'm going to set mass to be like 1 kilogram, just so that it drop out from all the derivation. But it's mass, so you can restore it very easily. If you see a momentum, then you multiply the velocity by mass. Okay, with that, basically what I'm saying is I'm going to define p mu to be dx mu d tau, which is the same thing as the u mu. And to further simplify the notation, we denote this as a prime. So every prime is a derivative with respect to the proper time, which you should also seen from GR. And all I'm doing so far is trying to write this equation as minus p0 squared, and I'm just going to call this crazy part a big p squared equals minus 1. So this is our energy momentum relationship that I could have written down in the first place. This says a massive particle satisfy a energy momentum relationship written like this. That's why we define this whole thing to be some spatial magnitude of a spatial momentum square, such that this resembles something we know very well, which is this thing. Okay? So this is before we dive into all those differential equations, which are not good, we will first focus on some integral constant. And the integral constant we definitely have for a mass of a particle is the energy momentum relationship. Except in this metric, we made some special definitions such that it looks like this. But it still looks something familiar, except this P, big P is defined weirdly. Okay, so the next thing, The next thing we're gonna do is the geodesic equation. And as many of you have been through the interview with me, you would know that this is the geodesic equation. And I wonder how many of you would be very excited to calculate the Christoffel symbol with me for that metric. I'm not excited, so let's try. Good, because that's not what we're going to do. We'll try to get the geodesic equation from somewhere else. It's slightly simpler. But remember, how did we get the geodesic equation? Normally, if you get some equation of motion, it's probably from an Euler-Lagrangian equation. And remember, for a mass of a particle moving in a water line, the Lagrangian is just the proper time. So, okay, I'll write it somewhere here. What you remember is something like this times d tau, but this is just one, so it's like this. That's the action of, yeah? Is it visible? This is the one you're familiar with. But I'm sure that at some point, David must have taught you that it's okay if you throw the square root away. If you just use the Lagrangian without the square root, you'll get the same Euler Lagrangian equation. You might not be able to use the one without a square root for other purpose, but if you just want the equation, you don't need to carry the square root. I'm not carrying the square root. I'm just going to take whatever in the square root, which is this guy, to be my Lagrangian. And if you go through the process, you will get the geodesic equation. Okay, now we just need to get one equation out of this Euler-Lagrangian equation. We would have got four, but we only need one. Because we're studying galaxies, you know, there are things that are not moving that fast, so only the time component matters. Remember all those arguments from GR? So we're only looking at the time component of this equation. So the thing we need to get is partial L, partial T prime, prime, equals partial L, partial T, right? That's a standard Euler-Lagrangian equation applying to one component. Okay, so after we get this, we'll get the geodesic equation, and I guarantee you it's shorter than the Christoffel symbol root. Okay, so let's do it. Oh, I'm just gonna copy it over. And the P0, let's remind ourselves P0 is nothing but the T prime. If you look at that equation. But P square has a lot of crap, but it's captured in this parenthesis. You don't even need to write it out. It's just like some blobby things there. Okay, so do the partial T prime is not hard. This is minus T prime square, so that's minus 2P prime, and they say you do another prime. But the T prime is actually just P0. So this is what it is. There's only one component that depends on T prime, And that's it. And it's t prime squared. We like things squared. And then we're going to find partial L partial t. And the only t dependence hides here. Yeah? So it's 2a, a dot, times that blobby thing. But then we're going to use the same trick. We're going to divide a and multiply it by a. Because we like this Hubble parameter for some reason, which soon we'll see that it's indeed a very important parameter. But for now, well, we'll just say that if we do that, we can capture all these things in this p squared. So we're done. We find our geodesic equation, which is this guy. So remember what we did? We write down the Lagrangian for a massive particle, and we find the Lagrangian equation for it, and that's it. Okay, now let's solve this thing. But there is all this, what's P0, what am I solving? Okay, this is kind of crazy, but let's make use our energy momentum relationship again to hopefully things simplify. So from now on, I'm gonna solve it by looking at this beautiful equation. And if you have been doing the embedding metric trick, it seems whenever we see such equation that we just don't think and do a derivative on top of it, mostly to get rid of, you know, the constants. So now, because of this energy momentum relationship, we have this relationship that we can get rid of the p0 prime. Not sure yet why we're doing it, but let's see where that leads us, because those are the two equations we have. Okay, well, things, I suppose, simplify a little bit. This p disappeared. And we like to collect the p together on this side. And I must have this two out of nowhere because they should cancel. And this side, we just get hp0. This is the question. What is hp0? Well, if you have hp equals 0, then you might die. But okay, so this is what it is. And I'm just going to write everything out. That's a dot. That's 1 over a. And p0 is defined by tt t tau. Hey, we can use chain rule. So this is actually a prime over a. dA dt dt d tau. So they can combine together. So what do we have? Is minus p prime equals, this is quite simple. This is something we know how to integrate. This is nothing but log p and log a prime. And this is only going to be true if p times a is a constant. So we find our result is that by solving geodesic equation, we realize this spatial momentum we defined is basically as the universe expands, this spatial momentum will become smaller, exactly as 1 over a. So how is this interesting? Well, this is actually very interesting. Because let's look at how we defined peculiar velocity. So this is V peculiar. Yeah? So we have defined the V peculiar before to be A dx I dt. So supposedly, I could definitely define how to define the square of it. Then we use some metric to add them up. Yeah? And if you combine this with our definition of our spatial momentum, okay, it's off by some dt d tau, but we're talking about massive particle, so let's ignore that effect. And it says, well, the peculiar is really just the spatial momentum. And of course, I'm off by a factor of mass, but doesn't worry me that much. But what it says is this V peculiar should just fall off as university expands. So if you have some galaxy that is wobbling around for some reason, and now you let the universe expand, and if that's all that happens, the peculiar velocity is going to be eventually be ignored. The only thing left is the Hubble velocity, known as the Hubble flow. Yeah.
How did you identify V peculiar squared with P squared?
Because V peculiar squared from this equation is defined to be AT dx dt.
Yeah.
And the P squared is defined to be A squared t, that is dx squared d tau squared, but dx squared is all those things. And the thing I used is d tau dt is approximately to be 1 for a massive particle.
Okay.
Yeah, so there is this approximation is using dt, d tau is approximately 1 for massive.
How long does it take to
for the galaxies to converge to a Hubble flow? I think that depends on which like error we are in. Like, you can take some approximation, like for dark matter dominated, and then you can calculate exactly what H is, what A is, and plug it in and see how what the you have to put some numbers. But even what we're saying is the behavior is that even if you start with a particular large peculiar velocity, you wait, you know, some billion years, it will go away.
So are we already there now, or?
Well, it depends on how close the galaxy is. Because the galaxy's peculiar velocity for the surrounding area is like 200 kilometers per second. So, you know the Hubble constant, you can calculate how mega parsec they need to be. But if they are pretty far away, and then they are probably not important. That's actually why when you measure the Hubble constant, it's better to measure the galaxy far away, because those two components thing, that for the nearby galaxy, you have to take into account of this peculiar velocity, but for the far away, you don't care. You say, I measure a redshift. I'll just take that as the speed. So that's why that, you know, back in Hubble's time, that's a small reason. The bigger reason is that we are very bad at measuring distance. That we'll get into in two lectures. And when people get particularly good at measuring particular kind of distance, then we actually conclude, wow, our universe is accelerating. That's exciting, because we have never expected that before that, which is kind of crazy. OK, great. So now we know that this is very interesting, that it helps us to measure Hubble constant. And we know that if we just let the galaxy become free-falling observers that their peculiar velocity will eventually decay away and that everything left is the universe expands and the galaxies expand with the universe. As I said, since it's a kind of long calculation, let's try to squeeze more, you know, fruit out of this calculation. And we'll take a leap of faith and apply our results to photons. Okay. Well, you know, for photons, of course, this whole thing doesn't work because my Lagrangian is zero. And my proper time is zero and all that good stuff. So for the proper treatment, there's a reference you can look at it. But the point is the result holds. Somehow, if you go through the whole calculation for photons, you still manage to get this result. Well, you would say that this result makes sense, so that you will be more willing to take this leap of faith after we explain the result. So suppose we can use this result, and now we have a fantastically simple energy-momentum relationship, because there's no mass. Then we say P0, which is often defined to be the energy, is just P, which is also proportion to 1 inverse A. But the energy of a photon is given by HF. And F is 2 pi over lambda. So this says the wavelength of a photon would be proportional to the scale factor. It makes sense. There's a wavelength of a photon. The universe gets stretched. The wavelengths get stretched exactly the same way. Because they are, it's, makes sense. So although this is kind of a leap of faith that it still works for photon, but what do we come out of it? It's something that we can believe. All right, so the next thing we do is we can write this thing very explicitly. What do I mean by wavelength? It's proportion to scale factor. This is precisely what I meant. You divide it by itself, you get a constant. And of course, this all ties back with the definition of the redshift. I think this is longer, so let's do this. So this is the definition of the redshift. Is to use the whatever we observed divided by the emission minus 1. And with that formula, we realize this is what we get. And I'm just moving the one to the left. Okay, so I'll explain this step after we get the result. But now, usually, we'll just take the scale factor today to be 1. We actually can do that. I'll explain later. But this is what normally is done, is to take today's scale factor to be 1, so everything in the past is some small number. So this is what we said, is actually redshift is related to the scale factor about how universe expands. So now we're just going to do some linear expansion. Says this is the function of time, so I can define by a dot times the t. I'm literally doing Taylor expansion. This is called a nearby galaxy. And we're taking everything at today. So this is 1 again, and this is the Hubble constant today. And then the linear expand again. You get, I like this number to be pulse, positive, so I'm just switching. Today's the universe is older than like the yesterday's. So now we realize we get Z equals H naught times T zero, whatever our expansion parameter is. And the last step is realize Z is V over C for nearby galaxy. And then we just multiply C to the right, and we get this. So the Hubble's law is actually coming from the fact that the photons are moving in geodesic in this FLRW metric. So let's recap what happens. Is that let's assume photon behaves, the spatial momentum of photon behaves the same, falls off as 1 over a. Since the energy and the momentum is the same thing for photon, so energy also fall off as 1 over a. But the energy is proportional to frequency, inverse proportion to wavelengths, which means the photon's wavelengths just stretch as the universe expands. After we get this result, we can just use our definition of redshift to get this formula. Says, oh, redshift, the redshift of the galaxy is always related to how big the universe is at the time when the galaxy emits the light. So remember, when you do cosmology observations, the further you go, you're going backward in time, because only time emitted so and so years ago is able to reach us today. So whenever we see any galaxy, that's what happened that many years ago. So if the galaxy is, you know, I don't know, 100 light years away, probably has to be bigger than that. 10 to the 5 light years ago, then you get some light. That's what happens 10 to the 5 light years ago. We have no idea what's happening now because we don't have the time to know. But this formula says you can just measure the redshift of the galaxy, and that tells us about the scale factor at the emission time. And this relationship is exact, and it doesn't really matter what happens between the light is emitted and now. During this time, universe can do whatever it wants, but this relationship will hold. And whatever after that, that's some linear expansion, so it'll only hold for the nearby galaxy. But if we do it for the nearby galaxy, we arrive at exactly the Hubble's law. Before we thought, you know, that's just Hubble believed there is a line through those scattered dots. But now we know that if we follow some simple assumptions, such as the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, and write down the metric and study the geodesic motion, Hubble's law actually follows from it. Okay. So we studied the massive particle, massless particle. We are going to move on to the next topic, if there are no questions. No? Move on? Okay, so now we studied what, you know, particles or dust. So when we say dust, we also mean galaxies. They are dust for us. Then, of course, the question is, what about the universe? How does the universe evolve? For that, I also have two proposals, and I hope you will support me again. The first proposal is we have a metric. We can propose an energy momentum tensor, turn out to be the favorite perfect fluid one, is the one that is homogeneous and isotropic. And then we plug it into Einstein equation, or we'll certainly get the equation of all motion to the universe. And I see people are bored. actually, in case you are interested, there is a notebook on Wiki did exactly like that. There are some, you know, established notebook calculating all this stuff. Only thing I did is put particular that metric into the metric, and you just press a bunch of shift enters. In the end of the day, you will say the equation of motion, which is known as the Friedman equation. But keep in mind, we're doing cosmology. Nothing is very massive. So we can still use Newtonian gravity and Newton's second law, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So back to Newtonian mechanics. Now we'll just say that we have infinite homogeneous isotropic universe of dust, and there is a ball here. And then I'll pick a dust particle here and ask how this dust particle will move. Yeah, I think this is something you all know how to do. Like in first year in college, because this the what Newtonian mechanics do for us is that I have a dust particle, and if I want to study F equals ma, I have so acceleration is given by r dot square over r, and F is given by gm over r square. Yeah? Okay. It's very annoying, but every a show up in F equals ma is the acceleration. Otherwise, it means that the scale factor. Yeah? People agree this equation is right? Okay. We can also just look at the integral version of it, which says 1/2 r dot square plus, but it's actually a minus, this equals constant, right? This is called the kinetic energy plus potential energy equals to a constant energy. Make sense? And you're like, where am I going with this? Okay, good. Give me, you know, there are not that many minutes left. So let me write M in terms of that's what mass is. And now we're going to use what we just learned. Says that the physical distance of wherever this dust is equals to the scale factor times some coordinated radius that is independent of time. So this part is where the expanding universe comes in. Everything before, we can do it just by Newtonian mechanics. Okay, so now what I need to do is to plug in the mass and the assumption that r is that the physical distance is equals to coordinate distance times some scale factor. Okay, so 1/2 r dot square, which the dot only goes on top of the a. And the next thing to do is to put this, the expression of the mass in there, and I realize one factor of big R canceled. Well, I can kind of throw away the rule anywhere. But then this gives me some more stuff. Yeah? And R is just a constant for this particular dust particle. So I'm just going to get rid of it and rename the new constant the constant. And then, okay. The next thing I'm going to do is to divide everything by a squared and the half. So the half get moved to there. So that becomes 8/3. And that a squared disappeared. But I didn't quite gain anything yet because a depends on t, so I kind of just call that a new constant, so it'll show up to the right. And we know this. This is our Hubble parameter. And then this is some density. They all depend on time. I'm just going to erase that. And there is some constant. This is the Friedman equation. And I can tell you, if you go through all the GR calculation, what you get is that you change this rho to be matter density to be energy density so that it cooperates with the photons and maybe even cosmological constant, that kind of thing. But this is the equation for the universe. It's the okay, combine the one we're going to learn next, tomorrow, this is the most important equation for the universe because it tells us how A evolved. Oh, sorry, one thing, that if you do the GR with this constant to get equals minus K, so there's the GR calculation will change rho to be rho energy. Not just the matters, just not the red, not just the rest energy, but all sorts of energy. And you change that a constant into minus K, which K is our curvature parameter. Which makes sense. You plug in that metric in your Einstein equation, the K doesn't just disappear. So that's where it shows up. So now let's draw some physical insight out of this equation. Remember this equation that comes from kinetic energy plus potential energy equals a constant. And in particular, we derive it from some dust particle outside a ball and ask how this dust moves. So we're really studying throwing a stone up in the air. So of course, if you have throw stones up in the air, you will realize normally there are three results. Normally there is one result. It'll fall back to your hand or somewhere close to your hand. But if you're super energetic and you're really able to throw the stone really hard, then you will realize it will escape. It might be even able to escape to infinity. Oh, it might even able to escape to infinity has energy left over. So that's precisely the three conditions, the three cases described by our curvature parameter. So if you look at this constant, it happened to be minus k, but that's okay. If k is zero, which means, you know, you have they exactly balanced off. That's the case that the stone just asymptotically escaped to infinity at a speed zero. And if you have k plus one, then it seems you have total negative energy, which means your energy is not it's not energetic enough, so it will come back at some point. So if you want to draw some thing out of it, you say at of t, then you would say in the case of k positive, you would say something like this. It seems that you're going to come back just with the stone energy, that you have some maximum A. You can also see that by realize, okay, so that's from the throwing stone energy, but you can also just move this factor to the right. And it says if K is positive, then this A dot A square, A dot has a chance to be zero. See, if K is positive, then you have something balanced out. Then you have a chance to stop the expansion coming back to collapse. And if K is negative or zero, then there's no chance. So you just keep expanding, some corresponding to open universe, some. Then, because this guy comes back, the universe has a maximum scale factor. This is called the closed universe. And then there is the flat universe, because k is equals to zero, and the other one is called the open universe, because the opposite of closed is open. So you can say it in two ways. One way is thinking about the energy conservation, what happens to if you throw a stone. The other way is to actually look at A dot A and say if the right-hand side has ever chance to reach zero. Either way, you reach to the conclusion is for the closed universe, the scale factor will reach to the maximum. Otherwise, it would not. Okay, so tomorrow we are actually going to do something, because this equation, from this equation alone, we cannot solve the universe yet. We have this. Two unknowns, one equation. So what we're going to do tomorrow is to find the second equation, and hopefully that we'll write rho in terms of something so we can solve. But actually, that's not good enough either, because that introduced yet another new thing. But that will introduce a third equation, and that is the end of introduction of equation. Then we finally will have the equation that describes our evolution of universe. You can just plug that equation to Mathematica, says ND solve, give some initial condition, then you will find how our universe scale factor evolve as a function of t. So that's what we will do tomorrow.